Okay, guys, I have to read this. The information on this call is intended for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease, nor do we guarantee the prevention or cure of any disease. As with any information that affects your health, we encourage you to discuss any information on this call with your healthcare provider, which they probably won't know anything about, but that's okay. We got to educate them, too.
Hi, I'm Josh Myers. This is my mom, Polly Myers. For anybody who's finding us randomly, you know, we spent a lot of time first making the program, and myself personally, I did the math. I think that's about 13 years now I've been working with people with anxiety disorders and the depression that comes with it. So I just wanted to give a brief introduction to who we are.
Yes, and I struggled for over 40 years. I still struggle. It's not perfect, but compared to my life before when I couldn't even walk out my front door, life is a lot better. And we discovered this puzzle piece for anxiety in about 1996. So how many years has that been that I've been on the program?
Almost 20.
Yeah. Oh, really? You're right.
And, weird, huh?
Yeah. And what's unique about me and Josh is that neither one of us really have any memory of being normal. We started very young. And the longer you've been on it and the less good memories that you have, the longer it takes we call it unimprinting. If you've been through the program, you know what we're talking about. The longer it takes to unimprint all those things, because I was afraid of everything. Well, I wasn't afraid of everything. The chemistry of fear would fire off with everything, literally everything. I mean, the telephone ringing would set mine off. So I had to rebuild, and that's what I've been doing these last years. I mean, instantly my life started feeling better, and my body started calming down, but I had to unimprint all my triggers. And I, since then, have been to Europe 3 times. I've been to Hawaii 5 times, Canada numerous times, Mexico numerous times, Caribbean, Bahamas. I've sailed across the Atlantic for 6 days in a hurricane with no land in sight. So I'd say that's a far different from being shut in my house and just wishing I'd die. So, Josh, you want to add anything before we get started?
Well, yeah. I mean, my story, I started a little bit earlier than my mom at 5 years with age. But, you know, here it is springtime, and I'm getting ready to bust out my sailplane, my glider. I'll set it up and start flying it. The weather's good enough now. I wish they'd be ready. But here I am in Utah, looking forward to, you know, flying gliders. I'll probably teach some lessons during the summertime. I see clients via the phone, via Skype, all throughout my day, and I'm pretty pleased. I skied all winter. A thing that would be traditionally hard for me would be getting on a public bus, and I made a point of a number of times this winter just riding the public bus up to ski all day and then coming back home.
I know.
So,
I made it a point when I went to Europe to ride the metro. We don't have that out here. I did it in Washington and New York and then in Paris and Rome. I on purpose got on the, well, they call them metros and undergrounds. I was in England too. And I just loved it. Man, in 5 minutes you could zip here and there and it was wonderful, but we're all packed in like sardines and there's no bathrooms and the things that were really bothersome to me, and I had a great time. So, way different life. And Josh, you can just fly and get stuck any old where and have to be brought back, towed back. And
yeah, when you fly something without an engine, you don't always get to choose where you end up.
I know.
So, yeah, sometimes we'll land out in a field in the middle of nowhere. And, yeah, you know, I'm not thrilled about the prospect, but, you know, it's an adventure, and you hang out until someone comes and gets you, or you get an airplane that lands near enough to you to connect back on. And
I know. And
home.
Compare that to when you couldn't eat or sleep or go to school or work or, I mean, you certainly didn't date. You never thought you'd get married and have kids. That was just way beyond, and now you have everything and do just about anything as a challenge. You actually take things on purpose.
I want to be honest, there is still anxiety that runs through my life. It just runs through at a level that I can manage. And the biggest thing that the Break Free program taught me is how to recover. You know, if I have an off day, I get myself put back together. Sometimes that very same day, before things like that might have set me back for a month. That setback, I get more setbacks, and it was a pretty vicious cycle. And now I'm able to I know what to do, and I love teaching that to other people.
Yeah, I've got a lady that I was hoping was going to be able to make it, but it's like 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning in Australia. And
right.
She started the program, and she was just doing fabulously well. And she did make it through her daughter's wedding and everything, and she did fine. And now she's crashed. And what she did was she stopped doing the program during the wedding and all the festivities, and now she's got herself in the hole. And I'm hoping that we can get, you know, her on the line. I'm trying to get her to call you, Josh, because she has a session due with you, and get her out of the hole. Because once you learn the techniques, then getting out of the hole is so much faster. I mean, I've had 2 major deaths, my husband's death, my sister's death, which was very long and protracted and a horrifically awful. There's just been a huge number of changes and mostly not good this year for me. And I started having the heart symptoms, the intestinal symptoms, but I'm pretty good now. And I would just have to come home and say to myself, okay, you're just like everybody else, this genetic, you know what it is, you know what you have to do, and let's get going. So anyway, let's get to the Q&A part. Okay,
right.
So you guys put your hand up if you have anything to say, just star 2, or write in a question. I'm looking for where I might find it. But anyway, the first question is, has anyone else had bad side effects from their anxiety medication?
You can put me on that list. You stayed pretty well away from medication, so you probably don't have any specific, answers. I certainly have a history with medication. So I would say I spent, it was somewhere around 2 years of trying thing after thing after thing, and the biggest thing is I found most of them didn't work. Most of the benzodiazepines do work. That would be Xanax, Ativan, Klonopin, Valium. But that's probably not a good strategy to have that be your only tool. Those are great tools to maybe supplement a little bit if needed, or especially to get through. But all of the SSRIs, so the Paxil, Prozac, Lexapro, Celexa, and we always have to remember for our international callers that the names are different, so you have to cross that over. They name them differently in almost every country, so they're a little hard to talk about. The quick story on the SSRIs is they had a really hard time getting those things out to market because they weren't showing effectiveness at all, and they manipulated the studies pretty hard to get them to where they would show some effectiveness, and I see about 5% of my client base doing well on them. I see about 10% getting some benefit, and I see about 90% getting no benefit and some side effects. The classic stuff with SSRIs is sexual side effects come up a lot, sex drive, libido. That is an issue. Paradoxically, anxiety comes up a lot as a side effect. That seems sort of odd to me that they would have a whole, in fact,
we had to put a patient in the hospital because her medication went paradoxical, and she ended up having a panic attack 24 hours a day, became dehydrated, had to be rehydrated at the hospital. So I'm not a fan of things that make you feel worse before you feel better.
So I work with people who are on meds and who aren't, and I am somebody who takes a small amount of 2 different medications, and it helps me. I have had 1 very bad reaction to 1 medication. That was probably after taking about 16, 17 different ones. And I don't want to scare people. Meds are part of the process. Anybody who works with me, I tend to just talk realistically about what they can do, what they can't do. They're certainly not a miracle cure for most people. And I'm by no means anti-medication. I just, they have pluses and minuses, and yes, all kinds of side effects. You know, I almost encourage people, if they're willing to try medication, just don't even read that little Bible thin piece of paper that's folded 27 times in the box, because you'll see a list of side effects. It's just endless. Dry mouth, nausea, sleep, too much sleep, not enough sleep, weight gain, weight loss. It's just about everything across
well,
the board.
Well, besides suicide and
so, yeah, the suicide risk thing.
Pardon?
That's a complicated discussion. You might be able to pick up that my mom's a little more anti-medication than I am.
Only on some of them. Only on some of them, because I'm really happy with the very quick-acting anxiety medications. Because when you're in a bind or when you're practicing, I find them extremely helpful. If you've just started downhill and you need to pull out quickly, I think taking a little Xanax or something, and so that you can get back into the things that we teach, is great. And
yeah,
frankly take it the night before I fly to Europe, and I take it while I'm on the plane, because why would I want to have a miserable time? So, I'm only against the ones that are making these poor people sick. Josh,
yeah.
Do you see that there's someone asking a question?
Oh, I do.
Okay.
Are
you in charge?
Yeah, let me see if we can practice this. All right, caller in Hawaii. I can't remember your name right now. Would you mind just giving us your question?
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, yes.
Hi, this is Cindy. I have a question, but first I kind of wanted to just share my story a little bit. For about 10 years, I was homebound. Well, you know, I'd go out, but I had panic attacks and everything, and went to the doctor, got on all the medications, made me suicidal, so I stopped cold turkey.
Only suicidal?
Well, hold on. What medication was that? Let's just, I'm curious.
Zoloft.
Uh-huh. So that's in that SSRI category.
Yeah, but that's, I think, you know, my body's just really sensitive to medications and stuff. But anyway, so this May, I was kind of at the end of my rope, and I actually had a reading with Venus about my anxiety because I didn't understand what was going on. And she referred me to your program, and I got the supplements in the mail and started doing, you know, drinking water, because I think my body, like, I stopped drinking water. I couldn't eat, stopped drinking water. And it took maybe about 2 weeks before I started feeling better. And now I just ran a half marathon. I'm excited to go out and do things. So honestly, the program saved my life. I was at the end of my rope, and I really didn't think I could take it anymore.
I love that.
Thank you guys so much. It's so simple, but it seems that I didn't realize I needed water in my body. You know what I mean? And just,
well,
just
it makes you feel like you're going to throw up, so why would you put anything in there? At least that's the way I was. So
yeah.
I totally understand.
I knew there's a question coming, but just while you're on this topic, you know, anxiety shuts down your desire for food and your desire for water. You know, you're supposed to be in a life-threatening situation, and those are supposed to be way down the list of important things. I would catch myself at 2-3 in the afternoon, feeling dizzy, a little disoriented, low energy, and I'd think back and I'd go, did I have any water today? Anything? And the answer was often no. And so as I got better, I needed to just remind myself, you know, I start each day with a glass of water or a hot cup of herbal tea, and I just make sure I start hydrated. And that's, because we get, you know, what does this one mean? We can get very wrapped up in that. And it's, the answer is no, it's dehydration. Everyone would feel this. You've got the lack of drive to drink water, and you're running through more water than a normal person because of the anxiety. So please drink
the water.
And also,
you're concentrating those chemicals.
So
all the chemistry that's in there, and then you keep squirting it in because you feel bad, and it just squirts and squirts, and pretty soon you just have this huge amount of concentrated, terrible, toxic chemistry. Dr. Myers used to say it's the most toxic chemistry in your body because it's there to save your life, so it's incredibly powerful. But for us, oh, my gosh, it's just sitting there are just toxic,
overload.
Toxic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Cindy. So do you have a specific question that we're
thinking
of?
I do. Okay, so a lot of the, you know, breathing techniques, I can't do the breathing techniques because it creates more anxiety in my body.
Sure.
I feel like, you know, I'll try to do the breathing and breathe deep down, but when I focus on my breathing, I get anxiety, and I don't understand why.
Well, first of all, it's
have
okay.
Have you ever had that?
Sure. First of all, it's okay if breathing's not your thing.
Okay.
Breathing does work. The first thing you're and anybody I coach, I tell people, I think I think I've had this exact conversation with another person on the on this phone call, that the first few breaths you're going to feel worse because you're taking your attention from the outside world onto yourself, and you're going to notice your symptoms more. And for me, the window is pretty short. It takes me about four slow breaths, which might be a couple of minutes, before I start feeling like I'm kind of getting into the benefit phase. But if that doesn't happen for you, it doesn't happen for you. Other strategies might work much better, exercise, things like that. I mean, it sounds like you've dedicated a lot of time to exercise. So, and let me just explain breathing in the way I explain it. You know, you'll read a million different descriptions of why it works. And all we're doing is we're...
Josh, I want to butt in here a bit because... there's different kinds of breathing, and I think you have a nice technique. We have one style in the program, but Josh has another one, and I've just read two more different ones. So, Josh, why don't you go through how you help people with breathing and see if it helps her, because I found it better than the one we have in the program.
So the first thing is we're not trying to do it perfectly. All we're trying to do is have our out-breath be about twice as long as our in-breath. And if that turns out to be 6 seconds in, 12 seconds out, whatever you count. I want people to immediately stop trying to do this right. And if you forget and all that stuff, this is a very big bullseye we're trying to hit. We just are taking, and we want to have our belly button pushing outward. Let me just back up. The theory behind this is all of our lives, we've been breathing in parallel with how we've been feeling. If you feel calm, relaxed, safe, you breathe like that. And your brain creates that connection. This is the same kind of connectivity that we talk about when we connect anxiety feelings to certain situations. So like 99.999% of your breathing has been done subconsciously. And when you feel tense, when you feel scared, your breathing changes, and your brain knows that connection. And so we're just kind of playing a trick on our brain. And we're going to force ourselves to look calm in the way we breathe. And as these upright walkers that we are, when we relax our abdomen and deliberately let it go outward as we start our breath, that is a horrible idea. If you're under attack, that's taking this vulnerable midsection and making it very soft. And so we're just, but if you look at when we're calm and sleeping, we will often have this abdominal breathing, but it's not an easy thing to do. So we're just kind of running that circuit backwards. I'm going to fake breathing calm until, and I swear to you, your brain has no choice but at some point to start calming down. It can't have that disconnect. It's such a powerful connection. So I'm looking for in through the nose. Again, that's not all that important. In through the nose, in through the mouth. I prefer in through the nose. And whatever I count to, I'm going to do double that on the breath out. And I'm going to relax everything in my body, except my pursed lips that are where the airflow comes out. That's the only one place of tension I want in my body. Everywhere else, I'm relaxing, and that breath feels like it's just naturally deflating under kind of like the weight of my chest. So the in-breath, if you put your hand on the center of your sternum and then over your belly button, the in-breath feels like a wave. Your stomach comes out first, and then your chest fills up second until they're kind of like even. The one up, then the other one up, and then they both collapse down together just under kind of like the weight of your chest as you breathe out. And if you aren't right with your timing, you just change the shape of your mouth until it's kind of like breathing out through a straw until you get that double ratio, that in-breath, out-breath being about double. And that's really it. I do about 10 minutes of that. And if I want to go on from there, there's other meditations and other practices I have, but I try to keep it kind of broad so that we don't get, some of us get very into trying to do things right, and that actually adds tension. So is that an okay description, though? But,
yeah, no, it does. Yeah, I think I'm always focusing on trying to do it right to where it makes me
right.
get anxiety.
Right. So I would approach it as close enough. This is in that horseshoes and hand grenades category, right, where close enough is still counts. And we don't, so perfect is not what we're after. And as long as we're close enough and stick to it and know that, especially if we lead active, kind of distracting lives,
mm-hmm.
putting that focus on ourselves is going to induce some anxiety for a while. And
yes.
instead of fighting that, you might find it valuable to just take note of what do you think about. It's not just a physical symptom, but there's a thought. If it was just a physical symptom that you were now noticing, it probably wouldn't go very far. There's this cycle we get into where we notice a physical symptom, add a bunch of thoughts about what could that be and all that stuff, and we kind of go down this cycle. And if we can just say, no, I'm just going to take some notes. I'll call Josh later or give him an email. I'm just going to take some notes. Here's what I worry about with my abdomen when it feels that way. And when I notice my dizziness, here's what that makes me think. And just become an observer rather than kind of a participant in this event.
Okay. Okay.
Strange idea, but effective.
No, I love it. Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much. Thank you also for your program. It's given me my life back, and I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, I'm going to mute you, but you can always hit star 2 again to raise your hand.
The second thing I wanted to just comment about was two things. I have this pulse ox thing that tells you what your pulse is and what your oxygen level is in your body, which is good when you're exercising and stuff, but I have gotten kind of almost, I would say, not obsessed about it, but I feel like it's almost a crutch for me. It's like if it's okay, then I know that, okay, I'll be all right. The thing that happens, though, with that is that, and this may happen to everybody, but with my general anxiety, sometimes in the morning, I wake up and I feel like not necessarily that my heart is racing, but that I feel this adrenaline throughout the body or centered in the chest area or whatever. And so when I check the pulse ox in the morning, it's like, 98, 99 oxygen level. So that's, fantastic. That's even above normal. And the heart is always fine. The pulse is always fine within range, but it jumps from like, I'll say 68, then it'll jump to 76, back down to 72, 68. And then, but when I do that at night, it's pretty steady. It's like stays in the 60s. It's like 65, 66, and it doesn't jump so much. And I'm wondering if it's just that adrenaline in the morning I don't know. I'm just, it was a little bit concerning to me. I thought, I kept thinking about what y'all said about that mitral valve thing, and I thought, I don't want to have to look that up because that gives me anxiety because the health is my real trigger. So I wanted to ask that question. Is there, do you know if there's a reason for that, or is that kind of, is it still just the chemical answer that, and because everything calms down after that, I don't have it for a long period of time, but it bothers me.
Yes, the answer is yes. It's just chemistry. I mean, everything you just described is perfectly understandable if you're getting hit with little doses of adrenaline. We're talking about, epinephrine, to be kind of technical. That's the scientific name for adrenaline, norepinephrine and cortisol. And we all have times of the day where we struggle more than others, and we kind of have a diurnal rhythm when it comes to our anxiety. I'm a bit of a morning person, but it's kind of odd. I wake up, and I'm more prone to anxiety in the mornings, but I'm also more kind of resilient. I feel like I've rested well, and I kind of have more capacity to handle it. So we can each design kind of a day for ourselves as far as when we do our exercise, when we get our protein going and hydration and all that. We are coming off of a period of time where our blood sugar isn't well taken care of. I mean, it is called breakfast for the break fast reason, and we've been sleeping for a while. And so, for many of us, the mornings are an issue. And, if I want to do the work, it's get up and get protein in my system, maybe get some exercise going pretty quickly, and then switch into a breathing exercise meditation mode. That all takes about an hour to get through all of that. Maybe we don't all have time for that, but yeah, if I want to take, and by the way, I do not do that every day, just because I'm lazy, and I don't always put in that kind of an effort. So yes, we have time for the day. Microbial prolapse, by the way, is what you were kind of getting at there. And it wouldn't be diurnally based like that. My understanding of microbial prolapse is you'd have these kind of inexplicable phases of high heart rate, tachycardia. It would last for a long time. They'd be very obvious, and I told you this before, and I've told other people that it's funny when we finally have a real problem, we'll know it, and it'll be so distinctly different from anxiety. You know, if we actually are having that heart attack, or if we do have mitral valve collapse, or if we do are really developing, I've heard everything, right? So multiple sclerosis and all kinds of issues. When we do have it, they stick out like a sore thumb. They look nothing like anxiety. They aren't confused for anxiety. And often when the reality of them kind of hit, anxiety is not very present. It's a very opposite feeling to what you, that typical, I have anxiety, and then you kind of dwell about a symptom and a potential disease, that pattern. The people who actually do get big stuff in their lives, it goes very, very different. So I can't say this is an absolute rule, but if you're having anxious thinking around a symptom, it probably isn't the thing you're worried about. So I'll just leave that alone.
The chemistry is going to make your heart increase in rate anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's supposed to do that. It's supposed to prep you to run and fight. And I was at my GP one day, and I happened to have an alternative GP, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. And I was in there, my blood pressure was up, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, thank goodness," he said, "I wouldn't want you not to. When you're under a stressful situation, I want you to have your blood pressure go up." And I hadn't heard that from any other doctors, you know, that I've been to. "Oh, let's put you on blood pressure medication." Mm-hmm. And you've heard of white coat hypertension, where when the doctor walks in or when you go into a doctor's office, it goes up. And he said, "Well, that's wonderful. I'm so happy for you. You're working just right, because this is a stressful situation." So oftentimes many other doctors will put you on something which will make us feel terrible, because the blood pressure actually goes too low when we're not under a stressful situation. So anyway, your blood pressure will increase under stress, and so will your heart rate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And
Perfectly normal. Yeah.
I know I want to step back, Sandra, to the first half of your comment, which was the idea that, you know, kind of going through what we would describe as a setback, you know, where you're out there in the world and you have this moment where the anxiety kind of rises and all the thinking kind of floods in. And, you know, I describe to everyone that those are absolutely necessary. The moment, I can't praise you enough, the moment that you just described is how kind of real victory happens, where you have this toolkit, you're still who you are, you still have the propensity to have anxiety, and then lo and behold, there it is, and you react in a way that quickly gets it put away. That's real growth. That has to happen. I mean, if you think about the what-if thinking that happens before you go on a trip, a drive, whatever, it's essentially what if I find myself in the scenario that you just described. You might kind of put a spin on it where it has some external component, whether it's weather or being in the middle of an airplane or around whatever, TSA agents. But the answer is, wherever I am, I can feel that feeling, I can get it under control, and I can move on. That's victory. And that's as far as I really expect to take people. Beyond that, they're going to be on their own, and every time that happens, they're going to respond and move through that experience. And in time, when that thinking comes up, that limiting thinking of what can't I do, your brain will say, "No, I got through the last, you know, whatever, and I'll get through that one." And so we choose to take that trip, or we choose to kind of grow our lives. So I can't put as big a gold star as possible. I mean, I can't overstate how valuable that experience that you just described is to long-term recovery.
Good for you. I'm really proud of you.
Thank you.
That's a really wonderful story.
It was a great moment,
yeah.
I have to say.
Yeah.
I really have to say. But I have to also say, Polly, that when you say you're on a firing squad every day, you're in front of a firing squad, you know, you feel like you're in front of that
firing squad.
This is a lot of work. I mean,
It is a lot of work. It is. And lot of our friends and family don't understand that we live in front of a firing squad when we have this chemistry in our body. It's as if they were just standing in front there and just waiting for someone to shoot them. And we go on for days and weeks and months and years living under that. And I'd like to see them do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really tough job.
Yeah, it is tough.
Yeah.
But it's,
but
you know, what are you
going
to do? I mean, it's just there are tools, and thank goodness. I really do believe that, I don't know if anyone's, you know, else is listening, but as far as the nutrients and everything that you put in your body through the breakthrough program, I mean, after about, you said, you know, stay on it for sure for 6 months and see how your body reacts. And I really have to say that I really felt not only that I was putting something good in my body, but it really did relax a lot of the muscle spasms with the magnesium and, you know, the minerals that you know that you're putting in your body that are good. It really did help to settle things down.
It did for me. That was the turning point because I'd had all the other possible therapies that were out there, and I'd get a little ways down the road, and then I'd just fall back, and I think they came out of the blue, and I couldn't understand it. And then when we put the pieces together, it was like, oh, it doesn't come out of the blue. Oh, here it is. Here's what I did. Next time I'm not going to do that, or here's what I'm going to do. And I started feeling sorry for my poor body. And I went, oh, my gosh, I haven't been taking good care of you. And that changed everything. And so I, like I said, it's been 20 years, and I would not do without the calming nutrients. I adjust the others, but the calming nutrients are there every single day. And you know that I have had an incredibly tough year, and I've had to adjust, just like everybody else. I've had to adjust. I've had to go back and do what the Hilo Hawaii person said, and I had to restart my hydration and, you know, the bowel function and the protein balancing and the sugar balance, you know, and all the nutrients, and I had to adjust them just like everybody else does. But I've pulled out of it, and people are just shocked. As a matter of fact, somebody the other day told me that they were sure that I hadn't gone through the grieving process because I was taking it so well.
Mm.
So
you have done incredible things since all that happened.
Yes.
So kudos to you, Miss Polly.
Well, thank you. You're so sweet. Okay. I think we're getting close, aren't we? Oh, we could do another question if anybody has one. Or if not, you know, there was one about, I'm looking for it, was about disassociation.
Well, you keep reading. I want to give a shout-out. Lee here is in Provo, Utah, I see, and I am not very far from you. I'm in Midvale, Utah. So right here in Salt Lake, we're all pretty close. I think that's neat to see somebody.
I know somebody in Provo, Utah, but I didn't know his name was Lee.
Well, that's what it's coming up as. I just
You should press star 2, this guy, and say hello. If it's a guy, it might be somebody using another phone. Oh, they're just not going to. It's okay. We understand. I would have to have been on the toilet to ask a question years ago, and I've been sitting here this whole time, and I haven't had to leave the telephone call.
Good job, Mom.
That was a big deal for me. I'm fine. I have no anxiety whatsoever about this call. So, but the question that I had, that I had seen was, this person is having feelings of disassociation and depersonalization,
right,
and it's terrifying her. And I can't find the question, but you want to talk a little bit about that before we hang up?
Yeah, that's a pretty a well-known phenomenon. We all have different responses to anxiety. Generally speaking, there's kind of a split that I sort of joke about. There's the me camp, which is what I'm in, which is the shaky pukey, and my mom's in that camp as well, or that's where, you know, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol, that's what it does to us. And then there's the other group that tends to feel more like they can't breathe, drowning, heart attack side. So those are the more drowning group. Neither of those are particularly pleasant. They both share in common, though, that feeling of catastrophe. If you look at our symptoms by themselves, not feeling like you can breathe, maybe more people can relate to that one. But in my case, you know, just feeling shaky, nausea, that by itself shouldn't be a big deal. But when it's mixed with that catastrophic thinking that this chemistry induces in our brain, that's what really takes it from, you know, just like flu-like symptoms to this, you know, a place of incredible torture. Really, the closest analogy to an anxiety attack is waterboarding, where you induce a sensation of drowning. We do this to prisoners of war, not legally, questionably. That's a longer discussion. But if anybody doubts the power of a panic attack, that's really what torturing people know what to do to induce people to the most suffering they can. The disassociation thing makes perfect sense if we're in this kind of catastrophic environment. Here read accounts of people who were getting mauled by a bear or got trapped under a rock or a car. Disassociation is a common phenomenon. We even actually understand the mechanisms of this. There's a receptor site in our brain called an NMDA receptor site. And that's the site where if you you kind of can trigger it manually using some of our earliest general anesthetics, phencyclidine, you would know it as PCP, and now they still use it today in human surgery sometimes, and they use it for animals a lot, ketamine. So if we want to induce that state, we know how to. We know the part of the brain that does this, and it makes perfect sense that in a fight-or-flight response, you could benefit from having a disassociative experience. So unfortunately, once in a while, to save your life, it becomes helpful to not feel some of your body and to not even view it as your own body. So if you need to rip your arm out of the shark's mouth, you have the ability to do that. If we felt all the pain and we felt ownership over that arm, that would be much harder to do, and that would lower your odds of survival. So again, it makes perfect sense that this is part of the fight-or-flight response. The sensation, if you read accounts, is that wasn't my arm, I wasn't really there, I was kind of looking down on myself. You'll hear different versions of this disassociation. So those of us who experience anxiety, some experience disassociation more than others. It's just like the camps of anxiety. Some of us are just in that camp. I get a very mild level of disassociation, so I kind of know what it feels like, but it's not terribly strong for me. And then I've worked with people that get a lot of it. So yes, it's frightening. However, you'll kind of get this theme. Step one is to understand what it is. And so basically, really understanding what I just described. It's a symptom. Here's why it happens. Here's why it's trying to save my life. And then you go, okay, now all that catastrophic thinking that goes along with that, you can start to challenge that. The model after that is the same as any other catastrophic thought that we have. This one just has a weird twist to it that is really kind of unnerving, right, to feel like you're sort of floating out of your body. And so catastrophic thinking would take us into the land of what if this happens all the time, what if I never reconnect with my body, things like that. And that's physically impossible for us to do that. These are transient states, just like any other anxious event. But that one's just, again, it's so unfamiliar to us that it frightens people, and I understand why. But yeah, we just start to learn about what causes it and why, and we listen to what the catastrophic thinking is when we start to feel those feelings, and then we start to teach ourselves how to respond. Anxiety by itself is only going to do a little bit of that. We need, with our catastrophic thinking, to really ramp up the anxiety, and then we can ramp up that symptom. That is within our control. I always use a 10-point scale, and baseline anxiety is only going to take us up to a 3 or a 4 without kind of any bad thinking or anything. We can just be having a bad day or a bad moment, but we are in control of what happens from there all the way up to a 10, and I can teach people how to interrupt that cycle and learn to bring yourself right back down to that base state and even lower. So,
I remember having things in the olden days that I had to do a month or 2 months or 3 months ahead, something big. Well, big to me, not big to other people, but maybe a speech or something or a class project that was due. And I would just be so anxious and not eating and not sleeping so well. And it would get closer and closer and closer. And I'd kind of, I think I did a form of disassociation, and I would sort of zone out where it just didn't matter anymore. And that's how I would get through whatever it was. But it was just and I don't care anymore. So it can be small like that, or it can be huge, like you think you're completely disassociated from yourself. So we're at the end of the time. You want to open everybody and say goodbye? If anybody wants to say goodbye. Oh, you good. So everybody, this is the end of our very first call. And thank you for contributing. And we will see you, I hope, the third Tuesday of every month. And that one will be 5 o'clock Pacific time, and which is the next day, I think, in late morning in Australia, which is why we made it at that time. So we may have some new people then.
Well, thank you all for coming and listening. I'm glad there are enough people that have some questions, and I enjoyed sharing what I know. This is what I do, and I really enjoy sharing what I've learned.
Yes, and please tell people that you know who are suffering or who don't understand to go ahead and get on. We're happy to answer questions from people who live with people who have anxiety, or usually in a family we're going to see more than one person. So if you have children, they're welcome to come on. These kids usually tend to be very bright, and they can understand what adults are saying. So our parents, I know we have several parents who've suddenly gotten it when their kids had it, and they didn't dip over till they were in their 60s or so. And so bring anybody on. The calls are pretty unlimited, so we can take as many people as possible. So we will see you next time. And thank you
thank
for
you
coming.
So much. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.